This is Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast. Greg, are you ready for the first question?
I'm ready.
This one comes from Kyle. At what point, if ever, is it okay to pull the plug of someone on life support? Could one argue that it is wrong because it is a form of euthanasia?
Well, basically, the rule is if one is not obligated to give life support in a set of circumstances, one is not obligated to continue life support in those circumstances. Okay, so this is a general rule. If you have a set of circumstances where you can say morally, I am not obliged based on the circumstances to intervene, to do something more, then once you if you are free not to do this stuff to that procedure, it is also morally acceptable to remove that procedure. Now, some might call that euthanasia because you are causing the death of someone, but not in any meaningful sense, because it certainly isn't required of us to keep a heart beating as long as it can possibly beat. All right. And there are a set of circumstances in which we simply let things go. This is classic in triage circumstances. You're in a war, you have wounded people, and you have to break them into three groups. The first group is those people who are going to survive without your help, and those people who are not going to survive with your help. Neither of those need your immediate attention. There is that group that will survive with your help but won't survive without it, and therefore you're going to focus on that. Okay. Now notice in that second group, you are not giving aid to somebody that might benefit temporarily from aid, even though not ultimately benefit. So you're choosing not to help them. And in choosing not to help them, they are dying faster than they would have if you were to help them. But you're not causing them to die. It's not euthanasia. By the same token, if you have a circumstance where somebody, you are helping someone in a way that you're not morally obligated to help them, and you remove that, then withholding and removing are not meaningful categories here, all right? If you can withhold, then you can remove, all right? Now the question is, under what circumstances can you withhold or remove? And generally, it's something like if the medical aid is not providing any meaningful benefit, medical benefit, all right, then you're justified in removing it. And even if it's sustaining life for a little bit of time, it's not providing a meaningful benefit, and it creates an undue burden on the person. This is the way it usually works out. Now, I don't have my notes in front of me, so I don't know if there might have been some more qualifiers, but my philosophy of ethics notes from way back when. But this is as I recall it. And when the part of the key here, though, nowadays, is that your decision cannot be based on quality of life considerations. So what happens with a lot of people if they say, well, this isn't going to provide some meaningful benefit. So here's a baby born with Down syndrome, all right? Well, there's nothing that we're going to be able to do to change the Down syndrome. So feeding the baby or hydrating the baby, which seems to be normal care, no sense doing that because that's not going to cure their Down syndrome. So we're not going to do that. Well, now you are withholding something that you are morally obliged to give. And that then becomes an act of euthanasia because the quality of life should not be a consideration. Well, they won't have a good life, we think. All right. That poor Downs baby. Okay, so we're just going to let the baby starve or kill the baby in the womb through an abortion, a selective abortion procedure that aborts, in this case, a Downs child. Incidentally, in, is it Iceland now? They have eliminated Down syndrome. They're so proud of it. And that's because they kill every Down's child before the Down's child is born. They have an amniocentesis, which is basically a search and destroy mission. They determine that this baby is Down's and then kill the baby in utero. Oh, we have resolved and solved our... Really? You can also solve every crime problem by anybody who commits a crime by executing them. What's wrong with that? It's the same ethic being played out here. Now, my point at this juncture is just to emphasize that we don't say meaningful benefit in the terms of what we understand a quality of life concern. But we make our reasonable benefit as a medical concern, not a quality of life concern. So, look, if somebody is dying of cancer and then they code, right? Well, what's the point of reviving that patient so that patient can die of cancer shortly, right? So reviving the patient that has just coded provides no reasonable medical benefit. And therefore, there is no moral obligation to give that. And if someone is on a machine that is in the same category, that there's no reasonable medical benefit, then there's no moral obligation to continue that. They can unplug them. Because remember, withholding care, let me back up. There is no meaningful moral distinction between withholding care and withdrawing care. If the care is required, you can't withhold it and you can't withdraw it. If it's not required, morally speaking, you can withhold it or withdraw it. So that's the basic formula. It's not always easy to figure out, but I will tell you this, more often than not, quality of life considerations get in the way. And it's not just quality of life considerations for the patient, especially in places where euthanasia is legal, like in the Netherlands. It is the quality of life of those surrounding them. Think of the burden that person will be on their family, and therefore they pull the plug. They kill someone actively because of the burden they will be on someone else. You see what's going on with that equation? So, there you go. Amy?
Greg, it sounded like just now you were saying that pulling the plug was killing actively, or...
In the case that I just described, where somebody is pulling the plug because there is a burden on someone else that is inappropriate, immoral, active euthanasia. Now, here's an old person that's dying. Well, you're a burden on somebody else, so we're just going to take your life now so you don't cost too much for your family. Your family doesn't have to visit you and care for you, whatever. Time to go. Say goodbye.
So an important distinction here is actively killing someone versus allowing the disease to kill someone and not intervening. So that's one distinction. And then the other distinction I think is important that you mentioned is the idea of food and water being normal care that everyone needs. Everyone who, if you're disabled in any way or if you're a child, you need someone to help you to have food and water. So that is a normal thing that I would not remove from someone because that would be actively starving them to death.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I need to refine this. It's not really actively killing them or allowing the disease to kill them. If somebody has, for example, they're diabetic, that's a disease. But if you have an incapacitated diabetic person, and you choose not to give them the medication, then the disease is killing them, but you have withheld something that you're obliged to give. So the distinction really is whether or not the nature of the circumstances requires that we act to give something, not just that the disease is what's killing them, okay? So I know that was in your mind, but it wasn't so clear in your words, so I just wanted to make the distinction here. The key is whether we're morally obliged to give it under the circumstances, And if we're not morally obliged to give it, then we are not morally obliged to maintain it. If we can morally withhold it, then we can morally withdraw it.
So how do you go about determining which situation you have, whether something is morally obligatory?
Well, one of the points you made is a good one. We are setting aside care. Medical treatment and care are different. Care is what you give any human being that allows them to live. Every human being needs food, water, and hydration. And air to live. So you have to give that, because no human being, no matter how healthy, will survive if that is withheld. All right. Then you look at the medical circumstances, and you have to ask: is the medical care that is being considered here, is that giving a reasonable expectation of benefit without an undue burden on the patient? Reasonable expectation of benefit for the patient, quality of life considerations aside, this is medical benefit, without an undue burden to the patient. So that's the equation. Now, there's still lots of room in there for ambiguity, and this is why decisions just have to be made based on the circumstances. It's one of the reasons, by the way, that Melinda is still alive and in the care situation that she's in, because she believed that no matter what happened to her, her life was valuable to God, and if her life could be saved in a reasonable expectation way, then it should be done, and it was. Now, she ended up an invalid as a result, and that creates burdens on people. But morally speaking, though, that decision would not be countenanced nowadays very seriously. It still, I think, was a sound decision. And I remember the day that she had her accident, December 3rd or whatever it is, now 2017 or 2018, and I had her copy of her advance directive, and I'm speeding to UCLA Hospital talking to the surgeon, and the surgeon said, well, we need the surgery tonight or else she will not survive. And if she does survive, she will probably not get all of her capacities back. Should I do it? And I said, I know what she wants. Her answer is yes. So go ahead and do it. Now, it turns out it was much worse than we expected in terms of the end result. But those are all quality of life considerations. She's still a valuable human being, made the image of God, and she needs care until her natural death.
And for some of our newer listeners, because Greg, it's been a few years now since Melinda was part of this show, but Melinda started Stand to Reason with Greg and mm-hmm. used to do this show with Greg. So our longtime listeners would remember that, but there could be new people who have never even heard about her. So thank you for that update, Greg, and mm-hmm. That explanation. I do often think of her when these subjects come up. All right, let's go to a question from Paul. When is it appropriate for Christians to stay and fight versus pack up and leave? I'm thinking in particular about Christians fleeing California over political, economic, social upheaval over the last few years. Is it time, as Jesus said, to shake the dust from our feet and move on to the next village?
Well, there certainly is a time for that, and I think it's a matter of individual preference. I don't know that there's a moral requirement. One has to weigh a number of factors. We live in California, and probably one of the, if not the worst state, all of those things considered. And people say, why don't you just move? Well, I live in California. You live in California, Amy. Alan lives in California. Meg lives in California. All of our workers live in California, except for Tim Barnett. And he lives in Canada, which is worse. Okay, it just, frankly, it's not practicable for us to pack up and leave the state. It's expensive. We'd have to reorganize, recapitalize for a new place, all that other stuff. And so we have to – it's a cost-benefit assessment, and that's the way it's going to be with anybody. Now, some people are mobile enough or they, in terms of their responsibilities, their friends, their relatives, and all this other stuff, especially if you're younger, you know, and professionally you're mobile. Then leave if this is overwhelming you. Right now here, what did I see? $4.75 per gallon as I was coming here. We pump the gas here. We pump the oil. We refine the oil. And you could see the pumps and the refineries and the gas stations within a square mile. And still, we have the highest gas prices in the country. Why? It's politics. That's why. It's all taxes. Okay, you can go to Iowa where they don't have any pay $1.75 a gallon. They don't have any, you know, oil there. It's just the way it is. So some people may just say, "I'm enough of that. I'm out of here." And I think you ought to. There's a huge exodus from California, and you can vote with your feet and go to those places where you're going to experience more freedom. But that's entirely an individual choice based on individual considerations, and it's just going to be a cost benefit. A big benefit, but it might be that the cost isn't worth it. It isn't for Stand to Reason, but it may be for others.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think, Amy?
I'm thinking about all of your decision-making material. I think some people have a desire to stay and make a difference, and some people don't, and that's okay. I don't think there's one answer for everybody. And so I think you're desires and your gifts play into this, how well you're doing here, what you want to do for your family. All of these things play into the question. So I would recommend your decision-making material, Greg, to anyone who's trying to figure out this particular question for themselves. I think we could squeeze one more question in here. This one comes from Justin.
All right, let's give it a shot.
Are vows of silence, poverty, and celibacy, etc., taken by Christian monks morally praiseworthy?
Well, I'm not inclined to think so. All right. Okay, so you have vows of celibacy, vows of silence, and vows of poverty. All right. If you have a vow of celibacy, well, there is an intrinsic good to getting married and having a family. It's hard, but it's good for us on a number of different levels. Both are having a spouse and having children. They, as one person put it, it's the toughest job you'll ever love. That is, it's really hard. If you want an easier life, then you can get you can be single, but you're going to miss out on a lot. Now, Paul talks about the advantage of being single, and so a vow of celibacy has that disadvantage, but it also has the advantage of for those people who are not sexually frustrated as a result, and this is Paul's point, they're going to be able to serve God in a more thoroughgoing way, pretty obvious. So that can be meritorious. Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 8. Now you have whole religious orders that are devoted to that have as part of their requirements celibacy, and I don't know if that's really worked out well in history. Individuals, yes. When you have whole orders, it seems to breed all kinds of other problems. Those celibate orders oftentimes attract a lot of homosexuals and provide an environment where homosexuality can be pursued, sometimes without restriction. And we've seen this in many circumstances in the Roman Catholic Church in the last 50 years. And I'm not going to say any more about that, but it's a matter of public record how this has been problematic for them. So I don't know that there's wisdom as a group, but certainly for individuals, they can make that choice. Vow of poverty, well, it's a matter of individual choice. I mean, if you take a vow of poverty, then someone's going to have to take care of you instead of you taking care of someone else. And in 2 Thessalonians, among other places, says that we are to provide for our own needs. And another passage intimates more and above so we can take care of those who have genuine needs. So a vow of poverty sometimes creates an artificial circumstance where we are impoverished and need help from other people. So that's a question. I've actually not thought much about that, but that certainly does come to mind when I think about vow of poverty. So vows of celibacy, vows of piety. I don't get the vow of silence part, frankly. I just don't get that. I can understand how people can have times when they are silent, and this may be have a salutary effect on their spiritual life, but I don't see how a lifetime of that does it. Anyway, we're to speak. As Christians, we're to speak. We're to speak to each other, words of love and encouragement, chastisement as appropriate, and we're to speak the truth of the gospel to others, outsiders. I don't know where the vow of silence serves the cause of the gospel at all. It might serve an individual for a time to strengthen and elevate their own spirituality. But, eventually, I don't know. That sounds to me like it is principally self-centered. I want this magnificent spirituality that will result from my silence. So my whole life is going to be, now it's built around myself. If you're silent, your life now is built around yourself. And your relationship with God, I can understand the motivation there, but it's still built around yourself. How do you engage in your community if you have a vow of silence?
I think with any of these, Greg, I think what you're hitting on there is what I would respond to these. With any of these, the first question you have to ask is, what is the purpose? If the purpose is self-focused, I think that's a problem. And I don't know exactly why that would be morally praiseworthy. I do see how celibacy, you know, Paul says there are advantages of that. I do see how that works. But I agree with you, Greg, that silence is a hard one for me to understand. And to be fair, I don't know what reasoning they give for silence. But if we're going to go by just looking at what Paul says about gifts, and he says the purpose of the gifts are, or the best gifts are the ones that edify the body. And so this is the distinction he makes between speaking in tongues where no one can understand, including yourself, versus speaking a word that will make a difference to people and edify people, because our gifts are given to us in order to build the body. In order, you know, God has put us in each in separate places with different gifts so that we can build up the body to maturity in Christ. So I don't know how silence would fit into that, frankly. I agree with you, Greg. That sounds more self-focused. If there is some sort of a reason that they think this is edifying the whole body, then I would consider that. But this is how I would evaluate any of these vows, just in terms of how they edify the body rather than being self-focused.
And by the way, that was 1 Corinthians 7, not 1 Corinthians 8, that talks about marriage. So, just saying.
All right. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Justin. If you have a question, send that question on Twitter with the hashtag SDRAsk. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.